Major support for Only a Game comes from Bicon Dental Implants. Since 1985, offering discerning patients and dentists options for same-day replacement of missing and compromised teeth. Information online at Bicon.com or at 800-88-BICON.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. The Mighty Ducks got mightier still last night, beating the Minnesota Wild 2-1 to sweep their Western Conference Final Series and advance to the Stanley Cup Final. Minnesota can perhaps take some solace from the fact that the Wild finally scored. Over the course of the series, Anaheim goalie John Sebastian Giguere shut out the Wild three times and stopped 122 of 123 Minnesota shots. In the finals, Anaheim will meet the winner of the Devils-Senators series, which stands at 2-1 in favor of New Jersey. Those teams play this afternoon. In NBA postseason action, the Detroit Pistons advanced to the Eastern Conference Finals by beating the Philadelphia 76ers last night, 93-89. Playing on an injured ankle, Detroit's Chauncey Billups scored 28 points, 9 of them in overtime, when he hit 3 3-point shots. Said Billups, "I'm not afraid to fail, but I'm not afraid to be a hero either." The Pistons will meet the New Jersey Nets in the conference finals, which begin tomorrow in New Jersey. We'll discuss the changed landscape of the Western Conference later in the program with Charlie Pierce. The WNBA's regular season begins on Thursday. This will be year 7 for the Women's League. Throughout the first 6 years, Clay Callum, the publisher of Full Court Press, has been following the WNBA's progress. He joins me now on the line from his office in California. Clay, welcome back to Only a Game.
Oh, it's good to be back, Bill.
During the off-season, two teams folded, negotiations for a new collective bargaining agreement stalled, and it began to look like this season might not happen at all, and then after a not-so-speedy reconciliation, the season is scheduled to begin on Thursday. I suppose collective sighs of relief can be heard all over the league cities.
Well, I don't think there was ever really much doubt the season would go on. The NBA, as usual, played hardball in the negotiations and just said, here's the deal, take it or leave it. And I think the Players Association felt, to justify their salaries, that they just had to fight as long as they could before they signed.
Mm-hmm.
They have no leverage, which is a pretty tough negotiating position to be in.
The toughest one I know. Because of the delay in getting a contract, the league did not have time before the draft to hold a combine. But the most interesting draft story, I would think, would be the L.A. Sparks, who have since suspended their top pick, 27th pick overall, Sky LaRue. And that means that the last four first-round picks the Sparks have made have not played a single minute for the team. Not a great draft record for a team that's won two championships.
Well, in addition, Jackie Stiles, their pick in the dispersal draft, is going to miss the entire season due to an operation on her Achilles tendon.
Mm-hmm.
But the Sparks have won two straight championships and are probably going to win a third this year, so it really doesn't matter that much. And they're still a young team, a young veteran team. Things are going to change next year, though, because there's going to be a huge flood of college talent coming into the league, led by Elena Beard and Diana Taurasi. And I think then you're going to see one of those low first-round draft picks make the club.
And if Diana Taurasi doesn't go to the team in Connecticut, this league doesn't know how to market itself.
Well, right now she's going to Phoenix is probably your best bet, because Phoenix is a weak team in the strongest division, and they're going to have a lot of ping pong balls when the lottery comes around.
The WNBA's other dynasty, if you can call it that this early in the league's history, the four-time champion Houston Comets, has added some new, or shall we say old, blood to the mix. 40-year-old Cynthia Cooper joined Cheryl Swoops in the Comets' efforts for a fifth championship. 40 years old?
Well, Cynthia didn't even really come to America to play until she was in her mid-30s and immediately became the best player in the league. She came back after 2 years off, pulled a hamstring, hasn't played in an exhibition game yet, but I think you're going to see by the end of the year a Cynthia Cooper who's capable of going out and getting 20 points and making big plays, and that's what she always did. She may not be the 35-minute player that she was, and she might not be 20 every night, but I have a feeling when they need her most, she's going to step up.
After more than a year of wondering whether they'd be folded or moved after the Hornets packed up for New Orleans, the Charlotte Sting have quite possibly the most enthusiastic team owner in the WNBA. Bob Johnson's new NBA franchise won't play until 2004, so I gather he's trying to make a good impression on Charlotte fans with his support for the Sting. Does that enthusiasm translate into W's?
Well, they have a pretty good team to begin with. They've got two great veteran guards in Dawn Staley and Andrea Stinson, and they made a nice pickup in the dispersal draft. But I think the surprise team in the East is probably going to be the Cleveland Rockers, who were only 10-22 last year. But because of that, they got a high pick when they distributed the players from the two teams that folded, and then they got a high draft pick as well in LaToya Thomas.
Mm-hmm.
They could be very, very good this year. In addition, Helling Darling came back after taking a year off to have triplets.
Of course, Bob Johnson has some competition in the enthusiasm department from the Mohegan Sun Casino, which owns the Connecticut Sun. Will anybody be focusing on the play of this team, or will all the talk continue to be about the team's unusual venue and ownership situation?
My guess is that after the first couple weeks, no one's even going to notice. If they put people in the stands and the team plays fairly well, they should be a contender in the East, I don't think anyone's really going to care that much. I think everybody in the United States, well, that's probably an exaggeration, but I think most people have been inside a casino, and after you walk through once and you see the slot machines and hear all the noise, you go, oh, yeah, I'm in a casino, and that's sort of it.
It's time, perhaps, for a prediction, Clay. As we've mentioned, the Comets and the Sparks hold all six of the WNBA's championships so far. You like Cleveland? Do you like Cleveland enough to be the team that finally wins a championship other than those other two?
No. In a word?
Short answer.
The team that probably has the best chance is the Sacramento Monarchs. They were ravaged by injuries last year, dropped into the lottery, got the second pick in Chantel Anderson, and also picked up a nice dispersal draft choice as well. And they could challenge either Houston or L.A. The key for all three of those teams is the one that remains the most healthy will probably win it all.
Clay Callum is the publisher of Full Court Press. Clay, thank you very much for joining me.
Always a pleasure, Bill.
The WNBA has gone to great lengths to attract followers and make them feel appreciated. It's nothing new to see members of the New York Liberty, Charlotte Sting, or Sacramento Monarchs signing autographs for fans. But one Major League Baseball team has made that a mandatory exercise for its players. Mark Moran of member station KJZZ in Phoenix has this report.
Before a recent Diamondbacks home game against the Phillies, fans lined the aisles of Bank One Ballpark in Phoenix, waiting to get down to the field, where D-backs players are signing autographs for people like Carol Gresham, who's been desperate to get up close and personal with two of her favorite Diamondbacks veterans.
Yes, I got his kiss, and I got the autograph, which was Matt Williams and Mark Grace. Got kisses from both.
D-backs fan Pamela Hanover recalls what she had to do last season just to have a chance to ask for a player's signature.
Come here, I'd sit outside 2.5 hours or 3 hours before the gates would open to be the first 50 people in line to sit in here for almost 2 hours before we get an autograph.
But things are different for fans this year thanks to the Diamondbacks' new autograph policy, the only such one among Major League Baseball's 30 teams. Eight players are required to sign for 10 minutes just after batting practice, about 2 hours before every home night game. The time actually counts down on the scoreboard. Diamondbacks principal owner Jerry Colangelo developed the idea with team officials.
It was something that we wanted to do as an organization, to take the initiative to do something that would be right, appropriate, and something we felt the fans would really be responsive to.
And the fans have responded well, even if some Arizona players haven't. Luis Gonzalez is the Diamondbacks' all-star left fielder.
Guys have routines of what they want to do, and they didn't want to have that interfered with every day. And, you know, regardless, of course, we have nice luxuries down here. We have TVs and stereos and things like that. But, you know, that's part of a pregame. This is our clubhouse. This is for little kids' treehouse. This is our treehouse for adults. So this is what we do to prepare ourselves for the games.
It was interesting because when first presented to the players, no one said a peep.
Colangelo says it wasn't until the Major League Baseball Players Union spoke up that there was any resistance to the autograph policy. But in fact, there was initially mild grumbling from some players and outright anger when the microphones and cameras were turned off. The original plan required all 25 players on the team to sign autographs. That, says Diamondbacks union representative and infielder Craig Council, is what players objected to most.
Well, I think the thing that, you know, if the players were a little hesitant of was the frequency of it and just having everybody out there every day. And I think when you're out there now and there's 7 or 8 guys out there, you know, when you think if there would be 25 guys out there, it would seem like there's almost too many guys out there, I think. So I think the way it's worked out is better.
Better for some players, perhaps, but others have expressed concern that their autographs would end up on the shelves of sports memorabilia dealers. Diamondbacks first base coach and Hall of Famer Robin Yount just welcomes the opportunity to sign.
You know, it's just an honor that people want it. You know, they think that playing a silly game like baseball, that people think that, you know, you're something special and that they want you to sign something. So, you know, it feels good, though, that people still remember.
For now, Yount and Diamondbacks players like Mark Grace, who estimates he signed tens of thousands of autographs in his 16-year career, will continue to sign for and kiss the cheeks of fans like Carol Gresham, who's back in line with her husband.
See? We're getting them all.
Good. We come 2 hours early every night to do it.
Yeah. Fantastic. I'm going to go try to get another one.
Oh.
Good luck. Another kiss.
For Only a Game, I'm Mark Moran in Phoenix.
It's 18 minutes past the hour.
Just a good old boy.
Apparently having forgotten that he was no longer at work, Formula One race car driver Juan Pablo Montoya was proceeding along a motorway on the French Riviera at 204 kilometers an hour when a motorcycle policeman pulled Montoya over. The officer confiscated the racer's license immediately and charged him with traveling 70 kilometers an hour above the speed limit. Juan Pablo Montoya's employers at the Williams Racing Team have announced that the loss of license will have no bearing on their world championship campaign, since the folks behind the wheels of Formula One cars are not required to have driver's licenses.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. For more NBA playoff highlights and other sports news, log on to our website, WBUR.org, and click on News, then Headlines. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Wellington Management Company, providing investment advice to clients worldwide. By ThoughtForm's Green Building Division, emphasizing environmentally sensitive and sustainable construction, located in Acton and on the web at thoughtforms-corp.com. And by Wheelworks of Belmont and Somerville, offering service and selection for casual cyclists and cycling enthusiasts for 26 years. Wheelworks.com, the New England bicycle source. Brisk and cold today, highs in the lower 50s, tonight's lows in the low 40s. Tomorrow, mostly sunny, warmer, highs tomorrow in the mid-60s to near 70. It's 45 degrees in Boston. The time is 7:20.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, good times along the cyber backstretch. But first, Funny Side, Peace Rules, and a cast of hopefuls will run for the Black-Eyed Susans at Pimlico this afternoon in the second leg of racing's Triple Crown, the Preakness. That gives me the excuse to say Hamburg Bell, Rose Ben, Citation Swaps, Conquistador Cielo, and Lemon Drop Kid, a selection of the horses that have contributed to the remarkable history of racing in this country. Mary Simon of the Thoroughbred Times has written a great big book about the sport entitled Racing Through the Century. She joins me now from the studios of WUKY in Lexington, Kentucky. Mary, welcome to Only a Game.
Hi, Bill. Thank you for having me.
One of the themes that surfaces again and again in this book is the story of the champion that impressed nobody at first. Back in 1919, I gather this was a case with an owner named Adolf Spreckels and a horse named Morvich?
Yes. Yes, he was a California-bred, kind of a plain, homely colt without a lot of pedigree, sold cheaply and initially ran in claiming races.
Nobody wanted him.
No, not really. Adolf Spreckels, who was the heir to the Spreckels sugar fortune, was a big-time breeder in California, and at that time he also had a colt named Runstar, who was a magnificent chestnut, very much looking like Manowar.
Mm-hmm.
Spreckels put all of his hopes on that colt, and Morvich was kind of crooked-legged and, as I said, plain. And Spreckels didn't have much interest in him and ended up getting rid of him, much to his future regret.
Right.
Morvich, for his new owner, Benjamin Block, he went on to win the Kentucky Derby of 1922 and went undefeated into that race. And the interesting thing about Morvich is that he never won again after the Derby.
Hmm.
And Runstar, meanwhile, the horse that Spreckels had been so enamored of, in no way belonged on the same racetrack as Morvich at his best, but he did run on for quite some time, and in 1924 he defeated a very old champion, Exterminator, in the Kofroth Handicap in Mexico. So Spreckels' opinion was at least somewhat validated in that one big victory.
The book proceeds chronologically, and when you get to the 1950s, you point out that during that decade, an awful lot of great horses broke down. Did anybody ever figure out why that was so?
The breakdown problems, actually, they've been with us, you know, all along, but they occurred with increasing frequency over time, and there are theories on it. The way we're breeding horses, genetically fragile animals have been increasingly produced over the years. The way we train them, the growth of two-year-old racing in popularity, running horses before they're physically mature.
Mm-hmm.
Racetrack surfaces themselves have become faster and faster over the years, you know, I think seeking faster times and that, of course, is harder on fragile legs.
You speak of how fragile racehorses can be, and I have to acknowledge there is one entry in your book that I wish I'd somehow skipped over because it was too sad being reminded of the story of Ruffy, and it must have been sad to retell the tale as well.
It was. It was heartbreaking because I had been, of course, I was around at the time of the great match race, the Battle of the Sexes, mm-hmm. in 1975. And I remember working out at a horse auction, Thoroughbred auction in California. And the day leading up to that was just one of celebration and anticipation. And everybody was excited and talking about it. And after she broke down fatally in that race that afternoon, when people came back to clean the stalls and groom the horses, it was dead silence.
Yeah.
It was just like a dark cloud had passed over.
It really is the kind of story that a writer of fiction would have trouble inventing. I mean, this beautiful filly goes out, wins all 10 races that she runs in, and then breaks down and has to be destroyed after the 11th.
Well, and she set records of one type or another in every start, every race she ran in. She was big and powerful. She looked like a male, you know, not a delicate filly. And she had such charisma. People were just enraptured by this black or nearly black filly, and she just captured the imagination of the American people, and especially women at a time when, you know, the women's lib movement was in, you know, full bloom, and this filly just seemed invincible. But unfortunately, she wasn't.
It is remarkable how, no matter what decade you pick, there is a horse, or sometimes more than one, able to capture the public's imagination. You write about Kelso, for example. New Yorkers would come out to the track each weekend, thousands and thousands of them, just to see Kelso.
That's right. I thought it was interesting that at Aqueduct, several of the record days of all time, record crowds, showed up on days when Kelso ran. He was just beloved by the fans. He was a gelding, of course, which enabled him to run year after year. He had no value as a breeding animal, so they kept him on the track.
Mm-hmm.
He did everything. He carried heavy weights. He ran long distances. He beat the best horses generation after generation on dirt and grass. Even when he lost, the people loved him because they had a sense that he was always trying his heart out. And he was another one that wasn't beautiful, but he had this essence of greatness about him that really attracted people.
Your book reminded me how often good racing stories have come from extended rivalries between great horses. Affirmed and Aladar, of course, before that Nashua and Swaps. Is it accurate to say that another theme in this is that sometimes the best horses, like the best two-legged competitors, bring out the best in each other?
Well, I think that was certainly true of Affirmed and Aladar. I don't think we would have known how great either of those horses were if they hadn't had each other.
Mm.
Affirmed, of course, came out on top, ultimately winning the Triple Crown over Aladar. But Aladar pushed him beyond the point of greatness, I think. And, you know, he was carried along with Affirmed in that. You almost always hear the two of them mentioned together, Affirmed and Aladar.
Yeah, that's right. What I found when I was talking mm-hmm. about in the introduction to the piece. You can't say Affirmed without saying Aladar. It's almost impossible.
That's right.
Now, I don't want to give our listeners the impression that this book is all horse stories, since there are some excellent people stories in here as well, some great one-liners. Jockey Bill Hartack, for example, once said, quote, "I admire turf riders because it must be tough to write about something you know nothing about." It was brave of you to put that in big letters in the middle of a page, I think.
I thought it was humbling because you know, you don't want to get too full of yourself. And Hartack was always willing to let turf writers and reporters know just how dumb he thought they were. He was an interesting character, extremely smart, wonderful writer, did not like the press, and always had something interesting and caustic to say about it.
Toward the end of this book, which is full of beautiful photographs of horses, there's a color picture of a room full of slot machines. Do you see the arrival of slots and video poker and things like that at the tracks as the beginning of the end of racing or a shot in the arm that the industry needs?
Well, I think more the latter. I think it's going to be what I see as a necessary evil because times have changed, and I don't like to see Well, I don't like change, to tell you the truth. I love that's why this book was so fun to write. I love going back and looking at racing, how it was.
Right.
Although I imagine if you lived through the times, it probably wasn't as pristine. Well, definitely wasn't as pristine as I would like to recall it. But the slots add a new dimension and a new infusion of money into a sport that really needs it. We have a lot of competition now, you know, with other sports, other gambling venues. It's racing has to change and move along with the times.
I've never been able to understand how anybody could go to a slot machine or a video poker machine at the track. I myself need all of that 16 or 18 or 20 minutes between races to figure out who's going to win the next one.
Well, a lot of people don't bother handicapping. I think handicapping races is kind of an intellectual endeavor.
Absolutely. It's the ultimate intellectual endeavor. And when you win, you get to convince yourself that you're very smart indeed.
That's right. Well, but I must not be very smart because despite all my handicapping efforts, I rarely pick a winner.
All right. Well, we're going to give you a chance to turn that around today because the Preakness, the second jewel of racing's Triple Crown, is today, of course. And though there's no actual handicapping in racing throughout the century, somebody with your background must occasionally at least pick a winner. Who crosses the line first at Pimlico?
Well, normally in the classics, now this is probably why I don't win very much. I generally go with a cowbred. I'm from California, born and raised. But in this case, I am very intrigued by Funny Side, the Derby winner. Mm-hmm. I love the fact that he's a gelding. I love the fact that he was the first gelding since 1929 to win the Derby. I love the fact that he's owned by a group of what you'd call small guys, you know, little guys in the business, mm-hmm. Kind of spreading the joy around. I don't see him winning the Triple Crown, but I'd like to see him continue on as long as he can go. And being a gelding, I also anticipate seeing him around for a few years if luck stays with him.
Mary Simon is the author of Racing Through the Century, a Thoroughbred Times book. Mary, thank you very much for speaking with me, and thank you for your pick. We'll see how it does.
Well, thank you for having me on.
Young, fine horses filled with hope racing around the track. The front runner is approaching the first turn. They're all racing hard. The front runner
That's not the track announcer at Churchill Downs, Pimlico, or Belmont Park. Real track announcers rarely say things like, the front runner is in front. No, that's the soundtrack of a video game called Derby Owners Club, which gives clowns like me the opportunity to sit down at a computer console and breed a horse, name him or her, choose the silks, train the potential champ, and then enter the beast in a race, all in a matter of just a few minutes. At the Good Time Emporium, an enormous arcade of games, video, and otherwise in Somerville, Massachusetts, Derby Owners Club has been delighting players for 6 months. That's convinced games impresario Mike Crowley that purchasing the more than $100,000 worth of equipment the game requires was a good move.
It's brought new customers. Customers who don't normally play our other games or play only occasionally will play this game.
And how long does somebody usually stay playing once they sit down at one of these consoles?
An average player will stay at least a half an hour. Some people play as many as 6 or 8 hours at a stretch.
Happily, there is food service at Good Time. Waitresses bearing French fries, nachos, beer, nourishments of that nature. But it's not free. Nobody's comped. It's not Vegas, Mike Crowley tells me, and it certainly isn't. The game is more complicated than anything in Vegas, something I learned when I sat down beside Ty Trang, a Good Time employee and Derby Owners Club veteran, and attempted to play it.
Now, I need to name the horse? Okay.
Well,
let's call him, O-A-G. Whoops, I got too many G's in. How do I get one out?
You gotta go back.
Back.
All
this
the way down.
Way?
Down, down.
Whoops.
Go down.
This one?
Remarkably, I did get my cyber horse, a gray filly out of Silent Lady by Hitmaker, named. She became OAG, or Only a Game. Cute, huh? Anyway, then I used the buttons on the console in front of me to move OAG around to pasture, where she acquired, among other things, a bridle. And then, after a few time trials and a sloppy meal of big orange carrot, I entered my filly in a race, in which she finished last. And then, like a clod surrounded by rubble, who's finally resorted to reading the directions, I asked for help from Steve Silvestri. This is a guy who's presently running 7 cyber horses and who's already trained and retired 50 of them for breeding. If anybody could make OAG run, I figured it was Mr. Silvestri.
I'll guarantee you we're not going to finish 12.
Well, he may finish first if all his other horses fall down.
I'm going to put some whip here.
It's getting exciting.
We might get it.
Come on, 8. Come on, 8. Oh, I think we made it. I think we're there.
We certainly did.
I think we're there. All he needed was a better jockey.
A much better jockey.
A better jockey.
Steve Silvestri's sure finger on the whip button comes from experience, of course, and investment. Yet even he is amazed by how much time some of his fellow players log at the electronic track.
I know the gentleman behind is Dan. He sat here from 10:30 one morning to 9 o'clock at night.
Wow.
Raced every race that happened for that period of time. A couple girls came in learning the game, and I had them in there on a Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Monday, and a Tuesday night. And again, 600 races.
Turn 18 and 19.
they did over the course of
how
five nights.
How much does it cost to sit there for that length of time?
Well, to breed a horse is three, and then $2 a race thereafter. So if they're racing 600 races, you know, they're making quite an investment.
That's $1,200? Wow. My own investment in the Derby Owners Club was more modest. In fact, I retired OAG after Steve Silvestri kicked her home for her one victory. Clumsy as I am with the computer buttons, I was afraid that if I kept at it, I'd run her around the track backwards or feed her a saddle. Besides, even if I got better at the game, even if I got to the point where I won all the time and bred champions out of my cyber horses, what, I asked games director Mike Crowley, would I win?
Bragging rights. There is no money. You don't win any money or anything at all like that, but you win a purse.
Okay, now, Mike, as you're explaining to me that you win no money, are you winking or you got something in your eye there?
No, you win absolutely nothing.
A straightforward enough disclaimer, don't you think? But one which, on this particular weekday afternoon, was somehow lost on my AirSat's Railbird buddies, my colleagues at the console.
It's getting exciting! Now they're in the final stretch, galloping, showing their heart! No clear front runner! Which horse will win the race?
You can share your comments with Only a Game by writing to us, care of WBUR-FM, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215. Or by emailing oag@wbur.bu.edu. Please let us know on which station you hear Only a Game and how to pronounce your name. You can leave comments on our listener line by calling 617-353-1860. You can visit Only a Game's website at www.onlyagame.org.
You and the CKY, what do you got? That's Kentucky. And it means paradise. That spells Kentucky, but it means paradise.
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR in Boston, where Only a Game is produced, and from the other NPR member stations airing this program. Additional support comes from Thermo Electron, the scientific instruments company with a mission to advance drug discovery, improve manufacturing, and protect people and the environment, on the web at thermo.com, and from Nutter McLennan and Fish, working to solve critical legal issues on local, national, and international levels. Information at Nutter.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. We are funded by you, our listeners, and by Adesso, adjoining the Four Seasons Hotel, featuring the Ligna Rosé Furniture Collection, open 7 days a week and online at their redesigned site, adessoboston.com. By Brigham's Ice Cream, introducing the new Brigham's Ice Cream Bars, a stickless bar of Brigham's vanilla ice cream covered in milk or dark chocolate, available at most supermarkets and Brigham's restaurants. And Boston Scientific, working to deliver what's next in less invasive medicine. More information online at bostonscientific.com. Good morning. I'm Dolores Handy in sports headlines. The Red Sox lost to the Angels 6-5 last night. The two teams play again this afternoon at Fenway. Nomar Garcia-Parra extends his hitting streak, his single in last night's game to Anaheim, extended the run to 17 games. That is the longest active streak in the majors. Nomar's career longest was 30 games when he was a rookie. And the New England Revolution returned home to Gillette Stadium in Foxborough today, hosting Chicago. Meet Here and Now host Bill Delaney and learn more about our next Citizens of the World tour of Ireland at a free reception on Tuesday, May 27th. To reserve your space, call 800-909-9287. Forecast brisk and cool today, highs in the 50s. It's 10:739.
This is Bob Oakes. What do you get when you make a contribution to WBUR? Balanced coverage you can rely on, pride in supporting public radio, and maybe a new car. For a limited time, WBUR would like to say thank you for your contribution for the news by entering your name in a drawing to win a brand new 2003 Subaru Baja, courtesy Cityside Subaru of Arlington. See the Subaru Baja and enter the drawing today at our website, WBUR.org.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, a new sports-based rock musical slides into the house. But first, our analyst Charlie Pierce joins me for a discussion of the week's sports news. Hello, Charlie.
Shaquille, can you hear me?
No, yeah, you're going to be surprised by this one. This weekend, however, the L.A. Lakers will begin working on starting a new championship streak because they're out of the NBA playoffs. Is the postseason better off without Shaq, Kobe, Samaki, and Stanislav?
No, it's never good without the big Aristotle. You know that. There was too much bad karma and weird craziness around the Lakers in this postseason run, from people being injured to the coach being sick. And as we said, I think at the beginning of the playoffs, San Antonio is the only team in the West that doesn't enter a series with the Lakers with, you know, fear and trembling. And Tim Duncan played an MVP series and certainly an MVP last game.
Tonight, the Sacramento Kings and Dallas Mavericks will play Game 7 of their Western Conference semifinal series. Does the Lakerless landscape inspire a 7-overtime, 193-191 offensive bonanza?
You are seeing a wonderful flashback to the 70s and 80s in this series. Largely because Dallas doesn't guard anybody and the Kings are a little banged up to guard anybody. But, you know, the story of this series has been the rolling back of the stone and the emergence blinking into the daylight of Nick Van Exel, who all of us had thought had gone to attitude hell a couple of years ago. But he got 35 in Game 6, and the Kings had nobody who could guard him, and he might just be enough to get Dallas there.
Charlie, Dave DeBuscher died on Wednesday at the age of 62. A lot of folks remember him as a very powerful presence on those championship New York Knicks teams in 70 and 73, but that was only a small part of his achievement in sports.
Yeah, he's one of the more remarkable figures in the short pants era of the NBA. He did two seasons as a pitcher with the Chicago White Sox in 1962 and 1963, when it was legitimately hard to get to the major leagues as a pitcher. He was commissioner of the ABA with all the craziness that entails. And my most fond memory of him is his little boyish kind of wiggle when the Knicks won the lottery and actually got to draft Patrick Ewing.
Last Friday, sports writer Sam Lacy died at the age of 99. His resume begins with the fact that he knew and wrote about Walter Johnson and Josh Gibson, among other worthies. He also agitated long and hard for the integration of Major League Baseball, and then actually roomed with Jackie Robinson for a time when Robinson did integrate baseball.
As important as Jackie Robinson was to his profession, Sam Lacy was to mine. My friend Ralph Wiley on the ESPN website has a great point. He said the Super Bowl started back in 1966, and Sam was 63 when it started. And as you and I spoke about earlier, Bill, before we started doing this, anyone who could begin a conversation with either Josh Gibson's name or Walter Johnson's is to be missed.
College football is in the news, never mind that it's May. The Atlantic Coast Conference is looking to raid the Big East for teams, I gather. What is the motivation here, and who are the winners and losers?
The big loser, of course, is the Big East Conference, which will cease to exist in any legitimate way. Its basketball-only schools will parcel themselves out to new leagues. Its football schools, three of the biggest ones, Miami, Syracuse, and BC, are headed to the Atlantic Coast Conference. This, I think, will give some of the people in college athletics a tough argument when the proponents of Title IX come to them and say it's all about football. Because if you want to demonstrate that college sports is all about football, it's the fact that the Big East Conference is going to disappear because the Atlantic Coast Conference wants to improve its football.
Charlie, we talked a couple of weeks ago about the University of Alabama's decision to fire football coach Mike Price for various improprieties. Now, apparently, Coach Price's attorney has appealed that decision. Is this anything other than a grab for severance pay?
I think he's going for severance pay. I mean, the notion of a lawsuit, should the appeals process not proceed to Price's liking, is weird, because after what's gone on, I can't believe that Mike Price or his attorney want to go through the discovery process what a lawsuit would entail. I don't know the University of Alabama firing procedures well enough to know whether they did him wrong by university process, but I would think that the university, if it can, will find a way to make this one go away.
The Colonial Golf Tournament in Fort Worth begins on Thursday, and it may immediately set a record for amount of attention paid to a tournament in which Tiger Woods is not competing. Does that seem like a good bet?
Yeah, it's very interesting these days. Tiger Woods is playing approximately 5 more PGA Tour events than Annika Sorenstam will play this year. Why is this a controversy? Rule number one, unwritten rule number one in the PGA Tour, Bill, what is it? Don't upset the sponsors. The sponsor, Bank AmeriCard, which is in to the PGA for about a gazillion dollars, wants Annika Sorenstam to play in its tournament. Why is this a problem? Don't screw with the sponsors. If the sponsors want a one-eyed Lutheran rainbow trout to play in their tournament, a one-eyed Lutheran rainbow trout will be in your foursome. Deal with it, lads.
This week, Pete Sampras pulled out of the French Open and Wimbledon, further suggesting that his pro tennis career may very well be over. Should that be the case, will Sampras have made the correct decision?
Well, I mean, it all depends on how his health is. It will be an interesting phenomenon, because 10 years ago, anybody who would have bet you that Pete Sampras would retire before Andre Agassi stopped winning Grand Slam tournaments, you'd have taken that bet in a heartbeat. But Sampras's body has broken down. He's got a 77% winning percentage for his career, and he will be reckoned with the greatest tennis players of all time.
It's interesting that you bring up his health and things that break down, because people don't usually think of tennis players as risking great physical damage. You know, football, hockey, sure, but tennis, it's true. It's such a grind.
Well, it's not just that. It's all the ergonomic injuries. Most in the dark days before sports medicine, most of the great tennis players, Lou Hoad comes immediately to mind, ended their careers because their backs went out, because of the torque it takes to serve the tennis ball over and over and over again.
It's Preakness Day, Charlie, and oddly enough, only one horse in the race has a shot at the Triple Crown. Have you shifted your allegiance to Funny Side?
Well, I have to, since none of the horses I picked last week are running this week. I'm glad that Jose Santos got out from under what was really kind of an unfortunate story about him carrying something other than his whip last week. I mean, some newspaper or media outlets were carrying something other than their whip in their hands when they reported that story,
yes.
I think. I'm going to go with a 20-to-1 shot named Fufa's Warrior, because I don't know who Fufa was and why he needed a warrior, but it's an intriguing name.
Finally, Charlie, this week, former Atlanta Hawks center Tree Rollins was named head of basketball operations for the Boston Celtics. Seems like an odd move for the Shamrocks, doesn't it?
What? No. The guy he bit was named. Danny Ainge.
Danny Ainge didn't bite somebody?
No, see? Great urban legends. I was actually at that game. Danny Ainge annoyed Tree Rollins to the point where a fight started, and during the fight, Tree Rollins took a little bite out of him.
And so how is it that down all the years, so many people I talk to still believe Danny Ainge was the biter rather than the bitee?
Because he looks like a biter. He looks like a kid. You know, you see babies, they say, that was a biter. He looks like a biter.
Charlie Pierce doesn't bite. He writes for the Boston Globe Sunday Magazine and joins me each week on Only a Game. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
You can take a closer look at this week's stories, peruse our archives, or sign up for our newsletter by visiting our website at www.onlyagame.org. I choose to believe that Annika Sörenstam is playing in the PGA tournament at the Colonial Country Club in Fort Worth next week for precisely the reasons that she has provided. She's looking for new challenges. Having dominated the LPGA Tour to the extent that Tiger Woods might be called the Annika Sörenstam of the PGA rather than vice versa, she's curious about how her game will fare when she plays against the best male golfers in the world, and whether, God help the other female pro golfers on the planet, it can improve. Some of the men on the PGA Tour are assuming Ms. Sörenstam is otherwise motivated. Fuzzy Zeller intimated this week that anybody who thought Sörenstam wasn't in it for the notoriety was an idiot, and Nick Price has agreed, saying Sörenstam's appearance, quote, reeked of publicity. Vijay Singh said he hoped Sörenstam wouldn't make the cut because, quote, she doesn't belong here. Tiger Woods, who's skipping the Colonial, opted for the high road and said he thought the only way for Annika Sörenstam to discover how well she can play against the men would be for her to enter several PGA tournaments, not just one. A comment that gives Messrs. Zeller, Price, and Singh another reason to hate him. What all these wealthy gentlemen of the greensward have in common, of course, is that they're taking the whole business of Annika Sörenstam's potentially excellent adventure too seriously. Come on, guys, it'll be fun. The Colonial isn't a major, and Tiger's not entered, circumstances that would ensure that almost nobody outside of Fort Worth would pay any attention to the event if it didn't have some sort of hook. And this hook is a pip. What would have been just another stop on the endless PGA loop is going to be a hoot. How narrow-minded, paranoid, humorless, and uptight do you have to be to figure Annika Sorenstam's presence will somehow derail the gravy train these guys have been riding? A gravy train, by the way, richer by no little and quite some than the one upon which Sorenstam and the rest of the LPGA pros have been bumping along. And if this weekend's golf feature publicizes that discrepancy, hooray for the long shot, say I. What rhymes with curler? Why, Sandra Schmirler. Brush yourself across the knuckles with a broom if you didn't get that one. Anyway, in 1998, Schmirler skipped for the Saskatchewan women's curling team and led it to Olympic gold in Nagano. Sadly, cancer took her only 2 years later, but now she's being celebrated in a new musical production which recently opened in the tiny community of Meacham, Saskatchewan. The CBC's Amy Jo Eamon has this sound portrait.
Our great skip is Sandra Schmirler. She is just an awesome curler. There's no one can make a shot like she can.
I'm Jeffrey Urso, and I'm the playwright for Gold on Ice. I wrote both the script and the music. I made it a musical partly because I enjoy writing musicals, and also it is a celebration of the team, and it seemed to me that in a celebration you have to be able to sing, and you have to be able to have fun in that singing.
It's a game of great anticipation.
I felt that I could capture some of their spirit and put it on the stage, and that it was a story which could have appeal not just in Saskatchewan, but across the country, because it is a story about how these four ordinary women got together and did extraordinary things and had a ball doing it.
From the hat right to the ring, sweep the ice and make the rock swing. When you win, you feel such jubilation.
I'm Monte Gagne, and I'm playing Sandra Schmirler. The play actually covers a lot of ground. It starts off when Sandra is still married to her first husband, and it takes her right through her divorce, right through times of real insecurity about her ability to curl, and into when she met Shannon and when she marries him and beyond. Initially, I was quite intimidated. It's a very sensitive thing when someone is so well-respected, and I wanted to be respectful in my portrayal. But I think, thankfully, we've gone away from trying to be that accurate because that's already been done. Those real, vibrant women have lived their lives, and that's the real story.
Hi, my name is Angus Ferguson, and I'm the artistic director of Dancing Sky Theatre, and I'm a director of this show. One of the things I really loved about this play is it always felt to me like if you played it in New York or London, nobody would know what the heck it was about. It'd be very puzzling to them. Yet, even people who aren't curling fanatics, nearly everybody in Saskatchewan wouldn't understand it. So it felt like it really kind of came from here and belongs here. When I answer the box office phone, people are always saying, I know Joan, or, I'm married to somebody's cousin, or I used to curl with Sandra. And, so it's very first-generation personal. It's very immediate, which I really like.
Hurry, 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 hurry hard! Not bad.
One of the challenges with putting curling on stage is that shots take a long time. From when a shot leaves a curler's hand to when it gets to the house. So what we've done with the set is sort of fractured time and space. So nothing's linear, nothing's straightened, and then things can happen at the same time. And the curling rocks don't go in a straight line from one place to another place. In fact, there are no rocks in this one. The challenge with this one is to sort of give you the feel of curling and the idea of curling without being literal about it.
Hurry, 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 hurry!
Did I just hear the mating call of a moose in heat?
No, you didn't. That was my best 11 sheets of ice in mid-bondspiel get through to the sweeper screech.
I think it'll work for me.
I'm Jennifer Wynn Weber, and I'm playing Joan McCusker. I mean, that long-angle wick shot that she did, we could never recreate that. And so I still have to throw my imaginary rocks, and I'm getting to work out that way.
Because this is a really theatrical play and it's stylized, the brooms are everything. They become the arch under which Sandra gets married. I don't know how much to give away, but when we rock our babies, yes, you may see the curling brooms in our arms.
10 reasons, we'll give you 10 reasons. 10 reasons, we'll give you 10 reasons.
Well, the team actually in their younger and wilder days made up a list of the 10 reasons why curling is better than sex. And when I heard that, I thought, aha, here is a song.
Number one.
And in curling, there are 4 positions to know. But you only have to be good at one of them?
And we are!
It was my feeling when I started off writing this that I didn't want to deal with Sandra's illness and death. I wanted to deal with the team and their accomplishments and to celebrate that. And the surviving members of the team felt exactly the same way, so we were in perfect agreement about that.
10 reasons, there are 10 reasons why curling is better than sex. Woo!
Our story on Gold on Ice was produced by the CBC's Amy Jo Eamon. This weekend, the musical will end its run in Meacham, bound for Moose Jaw, and Sandra Schmirler's hometown of Bigger, Saskatchewan, a town, incidentally, which welcomes highway travelers with a sign declaring, New York is big, but we're bigger.
Oh, we're the curling queens from the Queen of the Plains. We play the best curling game you ever saw. Yes, we're the curling queens, and we'll beat you the same, whether you play knockout or play draw. Our great skip is Sandra.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is Michael Garth. We had help this week from John Lumagai at WUKY in Lexington, Kentucky. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a tape of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287, toll-free. CDs and cassettes are $15 postpaid. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to hear this program again, sign up for the Only a Game newsletter or check out Virtual Racing in Cyber Kentucky, a.k.a. Somerville, Massachusetts. Please visit our website, onlyagame.org. Our final word this week comes from the cast of Gold on Ice.
Oh, we're the curling queens from the Queen of the Plains. We play the best curling game you ever saw.
It kind of makes you wonder if there's any sport about which somebody couldn't write a musical comedy, doesn't it? Contest ends at midnight. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Had to hit and stick, not jam her.
And our skip through her rock on the money.
We lost the next game, but we knew that in the third we'd all come through.
Curling queens all once more in such harmony. Curling queens all once more in such harmony, harmony, harmony. Curling queens all once more in such harmony.
Major support for Only a Game comes from Bicon Dental Implants, offering discerning patients a same-day tooth replacement solution for failed root canal treated or missing teeth. Information is available online at bicon.com or at 800-88-BICON.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is WBUR.
Radio.
This is WBUR.